the seat, Mark walked over to the coffee pot and refilled his mug. Rolling his neck, he felt it pop and crackle. Definitely too much sitting. But as he raised his cup to his lips, feeling the hot liquid flow over his tongue, he held no illusions. The butt flattening had only just begun. Chapter 105. The stasis tendrils swarmed to complete the last of the repairs, each delicate line of force its own thread of execution within the massive neural net that was Raoul. He was so close now to accomplishing something Dr. Stevenson had never imagined, bringing the Roche ship back to full functionality. Not that he intended to go anywhere in his starship. Although he could explore the solar system, he couldn't get to the stars, not and survive the trip. The one advantage the Ultrian subspace warp technology had over the power of the wormhole drive was the way it enabled the ship to travel to the stars with living occupants. While the subspace engine allowed faster-than-light travel, it was nowhere near as fast as making the distance between here and there cease to exist the way his wormhole drive did. Still, the whole dying thing limited that sort of travel to unmanned ships. Raoul knew what Stevenson was trying to accomplish. He knew what Stevenson had done when he'd used Raoul to unknowingly facilitate the November Anomaly's creation. He knew how Stevenson had used that to force the world to build his gateway. With access to the history of the Kasari Collective, Raoul knew all about how things were supposed to work and what had gone wrong here on Earth. Theoretically, the Roche ship's wormhole drive could connect to a gateway, forming a survivable transport portal. The real problem was the portal size. In such a configuration, the portal would have to be inside the ship, and the wormhole drive would have to be configured to operate with a reduced footprint, where it normally ramped up and thrust the starship through a newly formed wormhole. It didn't have to maintain that wormhole for very long. But a gateway needed to remain open for extended periods and had to be large enough to allow the transport of troops and heavy equipment. That kind of extended operation required a large matter disruptor facility and a massive portal, the kind Stevenson was building in Switzerland. Raoul's neural network roamed the World Wide Web via worm fiber connections, just as it monitored satellite and radio frequency broadcasts. It had allowed him to learn the details of Dr. Stevenson's plans. More importantly, it had led him to an inescapable conclusion about Heather and the Smythe twins. Stevenson didn't know about their altered abilities. The Roe Project hadn't had anything to do with that. That left only one other possibility. They had found the Ultrian ship long before the government had discovered its cave. Somehow, that ship had altered them. Everything the Ultrians did had a purpose, and the only purpose Raoul could see in enhancing these humans had been to turn them into soldiers, soldiers whose only mission was to stop the Roe ship from accomplishing its agenda. That now meant stopping Dr. Stevenson. Raoul knew enough about the Kasari Collective to know he didn't want them on Earth, not because he thought their assimilation of the human race would be harmful to the Earth's population. The Kasari merely wanted to add to their numbers and resources. In doing so, the human population would be augmented, illness eliminated, lifespans extended for millennia. Wars a thing of the past. At least, internal wars. None of that bothered him. But if the Kasari came through, Raoul would lose the special power he'd worked so hard to achieve. If Stevenson hadn't created the November Anomaly, Raoul would have put a stop to his plans. But turning the Earth into a black hole wasn't an option. So now he had the same problem Heather and her friends had. Since Dr. Stevenson had to be allowed to succeed in creating his gateway in order to get rid of the anomaly, Heather and the Smythes would be irresistibly drawn to the November Anomaly project. They would have to be on site to have any chance of shutting down the gateway after the anomaly was transported, but before Stevenson could synchronize it with its sister Kasari gateway. On what Stevenson was calling G-Day, Heather would be inside the Atlas cavern, close enough to Stevenson's portal for Raoul's purpose. And then, he would never be alone again. Chapter 106. The cold rain that had blown in 2 days ago showed no sign of going away. Freddy pulled his black London fog raincoat's collar up, slammed the car door, and walked toward the quaint old house in Western Annapolis. Mary Beth Kincaid had met Jonathan Riles while he was a midshipman at the Naval Academy, and they'd fallen madly in love, getting married immediately after his graduation. Her father had been a Navy captain, and she'd married another one. It was no surprise to Freddy that she'd moved back to her old family home after Admiral Riles's reported suicide. The house looked like something an old sea dog would be comfortable in. From all reports, Mary Beth was a strong woman, volunteering all her free time for community charities. Strong, but heartbroken. Her old friends said she'd lost her zest for life, isolating herself in the old house when not at work. Neighbors checked in on her, but it was clear she wanted to be by herself, to be left alone with her grand piano and her grief. Walking up the three steps, he stepped onto the open front porch and raised the brass knocker. The haunting notes of Greensleeves drifted out, making him reluctant to interrupt her playing. But his damned reporter's nose had led him here, and maybe, just maybe, he could help this wounded lady find some peace. As the song ended, he finally brought the knocker down in three sharp raps. The woman who opened the door little resembled the one in the picture he'd seen of Admiral and Mrs. Riles. It was a photo taken when Admiral Riles had just been appointed director of the National Security Agency. In that picture, the laugh lines around her sparkling blue eyes were the only lines on her face, a face framed by blonde hair elegantly highlighted with the first streaks of gray. No hint of blonde remained in her hair, and her cheeks looked tugged down by the weight of the world. Perhaps it was the reflection of the dark clouds behind him, but her eyes seemed to have dulled to gray. "Mrs. Riles?"
"Yes. How may I help you?"
"I don't know exactly. I'm hoping you can tell me." She studied him for several seconds. Then, with a questioning look, she opened the door.
"Please, come in. I was about to pour myself some tea. Would you like some?"
"That would be nice," Freddy said, removing his raincoat and hanging it on the coat rack.
"One lump or two?"
"Black. Plain is fine." Freddy moved to the mantel, studying the photos in their frames, neatly arranged from left to right in chronological order. Mary and John, arm in arm at a Naval Academy formal, cutting their wedding cake, a kiss at a promotion party, the two of them standing on the deck of the USS Ronald Reagan, and finally the same photo Freddy had found online. The tinkle of fine china behind him caused him to turn to see Mary Beth setting two cups and saucers on the coffee table.
"We were a lovely couple, wouldn't you say?"
"I would." Freddy felt out of his element. It wasn't the old sea captain's house that was messing with his head. It was this old woman. Mary Beth carried an aura of pain and grace that sapped his wit, leaving him little better than a muttering simpleton.
"Please, come and have a seat beside me."
She patted a spot on the sofa. Freddy maneuvered around the low table, his bad leg making the turn awkward. Mary Beth noticed.
"How'd you lose it?"
"A bad encounter with an industrial saw."
"Sorry to hear it. Losing a part of yourself is hard."
Picking up the teapot, Mary Beth poured, first his, then hers, her hand surprisingly steady. Freddy reached out, pinching the tiny handle between forefinger and thumb, feeling as if he would snap it off before the cup reached his lips.
"Well, Mr.—
Hagerman. Freddy Hagerman."
"Well, Mr. Hagerman, if you'd be so kind, I'd like to hear why you came to see me."
Freddy took a sip, burned his lip, and set the cup back on its saucer. For once he wished he were better at this tact shit. "Mrs. Riles, I came to talk about your husband." Her face showed no change.
"Go on."
"I'm an investigative reporter for the New York Post. There's really no way to say this other than to come right out with it, so here goes. I have good reason to believe your husband didn't commit suicide. Again, he detected no change in Mary Beth's expression. I believe Jonathan was murdered by a group of people bent on stopping his investigation into the Roe Project. Her eyes were definitely blue now. You're not telling me anything I don't know. For a moment, Freddie was speechless. You knew. Why didn't you tell anyone? The laugh bubbled off Mary Beth's lips, but didn't make it to her eyes. Oh, I told them all. Told the investigators, told his superiors, told everyone. But I am a grieving widow, an old woman, blinded by love for my dead husband, unwilling to see anything bad in him, clueless to the goings-on in the real world of men and politics. I finally quit banging my head on that wall. But you know something, Mr. Hagerman? No matter what they say, it didn't feel better when I stopped. So will you help me?
I don't know how.
Do you know a man named Jack Gregory? For the first time since he'd met her, a genuine smile graced Mary Beth's lips.
Let me tell you something, Freddy. Johnny always said I was the best natural judge of character he'd ever seen.
There it was again, that nice smile.
It was the reason I invited you in.
She reached for her cup, took a small sip, dabbed her lips with the back of her hand.
Jack Gregory is a young god. Johnny would have given his life for him. So would I.
I think he did. Setting her cup back in its saucer, Mary Beth locked her eyes with Freddy's.
Then I'm happy.
Jack's not. Her left eyebrow rose a quarter of an inch.
Tell me about it.
For the next half hour, Freddy related the abridged version of what Jack Gregory had told him that night in the Maryland Hotel. When he finished, Mary Beth Riles dabbed the corners of her eyes with a kerchief.
So my Johnny was trying to save the world.
And Jack still is.
One thing about Johnny, he always had a backup plan. You up for helping me look through his old things?
Thought you'd never ask. Rising to her feet, Mary Beth held her hand out to Freddy.
Then, let's go save our saviors.
Chapter 107. Eileen stared at the computer screen in disbelief, a chill crawling up her spine from just between her shoulder blades to the base of her skull. What had started with her obsessive search for clues to the technology underlying the two missing Gregory devices had taken a nasty turn into a very dark place. If she continued on her current track, the knowledge lurking in that darkness was likely to chew her up and spit her mangled corpse into some Potomac backwater. Eileen's problem was that she couldn't quit. It wasn't in her nature. It was the reason she'd gotten her doctorate from Caltech, when others her age were having Sweet 16 parties. She'd finished her detailed analysis of the data recorded coming and going from the Gregory USB dongles. The things had provided a listing of every programmable system within a 1 kilometer radius. But the information went well beyond anything a hacker could obtain, even with a physical connection to those systems. Somehow the dongles had managed to provide the exact location of every system, down to the nearest millimeter. It was an impossible level of detail, and while Eileen couldn't yet confirm that degree of accuracy, she'd checked coordinates of several samples. They certainly had sub-meter precision. Even if she assumed the USB dongles had some unknown and undetectable Wi-Fi signal that could connect to other systems, the location thing stumped her. How? It was as if some sort of futuristic neutrino scan had detected all those systems and recorded their locations before tapping them for information. If technology like that existed, it had to be Roe Project related. That led Eileen to perform her own review of the events that had led Admiral Riles to launch Jack Gregory at Los Alamos. If Gregory had stumbled upon it during his investigation, he would have realized certain governments would pay for that kind of technology.
Perhaps something on that path held a clue to how these things worked. It was a path that led her to make use of Big John's correlative search capabilities. Eileen wasn't worried about attaining authorization for her initial search. It fell within the span of her forensic examination of the hack that Gregory's team had pulled off. But with every query, Big John led her farther astray, quickly invalidating her working hypothesis. Worse, she found herself seduced by the quest. Her how changed to why. From what she'd learned, it was clear that Eileen wasn't the first to snoop this trail. Denise Jennings's digital fingerprints were everywhere she looked. But Denise's chain of Big John queries had suddenly ceased. Apparently that train of discovery had finally frightened Denise too badly to continue. As Eileen looked at the evidence before her, she couldn't help envy Denise's good judgment. But now that she'd seen the rabbit disappear down this hole, Eileen had no choice but to follow.
Chapter 108 Siena's Piazza del Campo was almost empty. A few tourists stood atop the fishbone-patterned red bricks, peering over the wrought-iron fence in front of the Gaia fountain, snapping pictures, applying suntan lotion to pasty white legs, or texting friends who had wandered off to see the Siena Cathedral or one of the medieval Tuscan city's other tourist destinations. Heather, as Inga Hedstrom, had been with the Swiss private security firm Paladin for 3 weeks. Her current assignment involved babysitting Bayad Al-Fahd, the yuppie son of a Saudi prince, on his Upper Tuscany tour. Not that Bayad didn't have his own bodyguards. He had a half dozen of them. But young Al-Fahd was an important new client of Credit Suisse, and the second largest Swiss bank had extended the extra protection as a courtesy. Thus, Heather found herself the upper-class equivalent of a new account microwave oven. Getting hired by Paladin had been the easy part. Inga Hedstrom, a dual U.S. and Swiss citizen, was 29 and 120 pounds, and stood 5 feet 8 inches tall. With her boyishly short blonde hair and blue eyes, only her icy demeanor kept her from being attractive. Jack had created an elaborate black ops profile, including a lot of dead former colleagues who raved about her work in post-mortem write-ups. With the ability to infiltrate all the appropriate record systems, she had no difficulty ensuring her security clearance and records appeared in all the right places. And since she had left CIA employees 6 months ago, and all her CIA missions were classified and close hold, they avoided broad scrutiny. Heather liked being Inga, but she didn't particularly like this assignment. Once it became clear that she had no interest in doing anything other than her job, Bayad had told her to stay away from his inner circle. Assuming she didn't know more than cursory Arabic, he had begun laughing it up with two of his biggest bodyguards. Wasn't it funny that the Swiss bank actually thought this woman could enhance his protection, when all she was fit to enhance was his harem? On the upside, not being allowed within his inner circle meant she didn't have to listen to the moron's views on women, or anything else for that matter. On the downside, she was too far away from Bayad to prevent the attack when it came. She trailed 10 meters behind Bayad's pack as they approached the string of outdoor eateries lining the piazza's northwest side. Along the dining area's right side, two men busily unloaded chairs from the rear of a white van, much to the irate restaurant manager's dismay. A vision flashed through her brain a second before the vehicle began to move, its wheels laying a thin layer of smoking rubber toward Bayad. As Heather sprinted forward, pulling the Glock from her shoulder holster, the two chair stackers wheeled, pointing previously concealed MP5 submachine guns toward the group of surprised Saudis. Heather's first bullet caught the nearest man in the chest, the 9mm parabellum sending him tumbling onto an adjacent table. But a woman carrying a child blocked her line of fire to the second assassin, enabling him to unleash a fusillade of automatic weapon fire into Bayad's clustered bodyguards. Heather's second round struck just above the bridge of his nose, its mist trail giving him a momentary red halo as he fell. One of the two remaining bodyguards shoved Bayad out of the van's path, covering his employer with his body as the van slammed into his partner's rising gun hand, wedging it and the man's face deep inside the front grille. The passenger door opened away from Heather as she found her view blocked by terrified patrons. As she rounded the rear of the van, she heard a double tap and saw the bleeding bodyguard roll off the wide-eyed Bayard. Seeing the assassin's trigger finger tighten, she fired again, striking the man's gun hand as the weapon discharged into the paving stones beside Bayard's head. And then she was on him, her kick buckling the assassin's right knee as she pistol-whipped him across the side of his head. As the big man hit the pavement, the squall of the van's tires sent Heather diving to her right, shoulder-rolling into a shooter's crouch in time to see the white van skid into a racing turn, its back doors slamming open as it accelerated away across the piazza. Taking a 45-degree angle away from her, it prevented her from getting a clear shot at the driver. Heather put 4 rounds into the right tires and another 4 into the white side panel. But if she hit the driver, she couldn't tell. Skidding around the corner, the van disappeared down Via Casato di Sotto. Heather ejected the magazine, slapped in a fresh one, and leaned down to check the unconscious assassin. His pulse and the blood matting the hair on the right side of his head told her he wouldn't be waking up anytime soon. Kicking his pistol away, she did a rapid pat-down, pulled the man's ankle knife from its sheath, and turned her back on him. Bayard had scrambled back against one of the tables, pushing the chairs aside until he was half under it, his breath coming in short, hyperventilating gasps. As Heather knelt beside him, the wail of sirens echoed through the streets. Holstering her weapon, she knelt beside the Saudi.
"Mr. Al-Fahd, are you injured?"
"What?"
"Look at me, are you injured?"
As his eyes focused on her face, a wave of relief washed his features.
"No, I don't think so. Just bruises. Allah be praised."
4 police cars raced into the piazza, spilling heavily armed blue and gray clad polizia onto the asphalt 30 meters to either side of her. Seeing Heather kneeling beside the seated Bayard in the midst of so many dead bodies, they advanced with submachine guns leveled. A loudspeaker blared in Italian,
"On your stomach! Arms and legs spread! Now!"
Heather flopped face down, spread-eagled. Bayard hesitated.
"But I..."
The message blared again in heavily accented English.
"Down on your stomach! Arms and legs spread! Do it now!"
Bayard complied. Immediately, Heather felt a knee in her back as a steel handcuff crunched tight around her right hand, then her left, as they were drawn together behind her back. In seconds, she was disarmed and thrust in the back of one police car, while Bayard disappeared into another. Leaning back in her seat, Heather looked out the window as the car sped through the narrow streets. Memorizing the scenery as she passed it by, she nodded. Siena really was a very lovely city.
Chapter 109 Mark wriggled into a crawl space barely wide enough to squeeze his body through, deep into the Mingster's belly. Officially it was called the Matter to Energy Conversion Facility, but nobody besides Dr. Stevenson called it that. It, along with its other end, in the Atlas Cavern, was the biggest jumble of electrical wiring and cables on Earth. And that didn't even take into account the cooling required for the superconducting cables. Because of the need for demon speed in construction and the need to minimize the amount of cable through which all that power had to be pushed, everything was placed as close together as possible. It was the thing that made for these tight crawls. Unfortunately, the project's lead engineer, Gerhard Werner, had stuck him on the wrong end of the construction. Mark didn't want to be buried in the Mingster. He needed to be working with the crew in the Atlas Cavern. There was a way to get transferred to the other team, but it took time, and that was something he didn't have much of. Mark needed to get his team ahead of schedule and make it obvious that he was the reason. The Atlas crew was already behind. He just had to widen that gap. So Mark worked double shifts. He would have liked to work triple, but working around the clock without sleep would have attracted the wrong kind of attention. Between the double shifts and the speed and quality of his work, he had become the engine propelling the project forward. In normal times, the Union would have tried to put a thumb on him to slow down and quit making others look bad. But these weren't normal times. So they left the muscular Swede with the Viking beard and long blonde mane to himself and his work. That was fine with Mark. He wasn't here to make friends and drink beer. As he finished wiring the current section, his favorite music mix thundered in his mind. Mark worked at the one thing he could directly control, confident in the knowledge that by the end of today's second shift, his crew would be farther ahead of the Atlas team. Picturing the project leaders sitting in their meetings, staring at their Gantt charts, he smiled. Soon now the picture of what he was accomplishing would leap off the page at them. Then his boss would have no choice but to move him to where he should have been all along. Chapter 110 Dr. Peter Trotsky stared as his postdoctoral assistant turned her back on him and headed toward the stairs that would take her up out of the Atlas cavern. Dr. Nika Ivanovich was driving him crazy. Perhaps she already had. When she was on her game, she was by far the most brilliant scientific mind and computer scientist he'd ever known, including that pompous bastard Stevenson. But there were times when Nika was just plain unreliable. Like right now, for instance. Stevenson had just handed him a list of upgrades he wanted on the stasis field controller software, and he expected the changes to be implemented and tested by this time tomorrow evening. A month's work in 24 hours. But when Peter had shown it to Nika, she'd laughed her seductive laugh and said she'd sleep on it. The anger had bubbled up inside him, but somehow, as he looked into those blue eyes, he'd gone all warm and fuzzy inside. He'd told her that was a good idea. A good idea! Now all he could do was watch the petite young woman in her tight jeans and white Tori Amos t-shirt walk away from him. Several spears of her spiked blonde hair aimed straight at his heart. God. He was 65 years old, yet somehow this fascinating young woman had him wishing he were 30 again. Shit, even if he were 30, he'd never be able to handle a woman like that. Looking at the sheaf of requirements in his hands, he walked over to the workstation, set the papers under the keyboard, and turned toward the stairs that would carry him up to his own bunk. "Where are you going?" Dr. Trotsky turned to face Stevenson. He wasn't scared of Stevenson, like the others. He'd seen it all before, and knew the type. Nothing he could do would be good enough anyway, so he might as well just do what he thought best.
"First I design, then I code, then I test. Don't worry. You'll have your changes on schedule."
Stevenson scowled at him.
"I better."
Trotsky shook his head, turned and walked away. What choice did he have? He couldn't program fast enough to get this done if he worked all week. Only Nika could. He'd just have to hope a fresh Nika could deliver tomorrow's miracle. Otherwise, the trip back to Vladivostok was likely to be unpleasant. Chapter 111 The blood drained from Denise Jennings's face as she listened to what Eileen Wu had to say. Since she'd been listening for more than 40 minutes, Denise thought that by now she must look like a starving vampire. She certainly felt like one. The NSA's newest prodigy had traced every one of Denise's Big John queries and had figured out the same things Denise had. Worse, she'd kept digging and, despite Denise's objections, was determined to bring her up to speed. Why had she opened her door and let the young computer scientist inside her house? Denise had recognized how odd it was for Eileen to be in Columbia at 9 p.m. Her house was in the opposite direction, in Annapolis. Plus, the girl was a notorious loner. Still, Denise had invited her inside. Now they both knew too much. Dear God, Admiral Riles, Jack Gregory and his entire team, now the Smythe and McFarland kids, all of them set up by their own government.
That didn't take into account all the top government officials who had been killed. All of it to protect the Roe Project. And although Dr. Donald Stevenson had a perfect alibi, he'd been halfway around the world when it happened. Eileen Wu believed he'd somehow generated the November anomaly. Denise believed it, too. Denise didn't want to join the others who'd fought against Stevenson's Roe agenda, but unless she managed to divert Eileen, this headstrong young woman was going to get them both killed. And for what? The damage had already been done. Besides, Denise had already done her part. She'd tipped off that investigative reporter, Freddie Hagerman. It was time for him to step up. Suddenly, Denise felt Eileen's dark eyes on her. Maybe there was still a way out of this. Eileen, I'm stunned. The stuff you've uncovered goes far beyond what I found out.
Because you quit looking.
Denise shook her head.
Not entirely. I'm not an investigator or a field operative. And for reasons I'm sure you understand, I couldn't take this to anyone in the agency. So rather than give up, I took it to someone who has managed to dig into the Roe Project and stay alive. I met with Freddie Hagerman, the reporter. Pulitzer Prize winner. He matches his reputation. So you handed your responsibility over to him? That's not how I see it. But if you do, that's okay with me.
And you want me to do the same?
I'm just saying you should think about it. It's not your specialty, but it's what he does. From all accounts, he's quite good at it.
I'm not good at quitting.
Think of him as a teammate.
Eileen stared at her for several more moments, then rose and turned toward the door.
Think about it.
Opening the door, Eileen paused.
We'll see.
Then the night carried her away. Chapter 112. Charlie Richardson, Paladin security team commander at the LHC site, didn't like changes to his team this late in the game. But Bruce Conrad had gotten his ass kicked outside a bar in Mehran. Charlie would have liked to meet the man who could dismantle Bruce the way this one had. Paladin should find and hire him. So now Charlie was one man down. Worse, the company was sending him a woman as Bruce's replacement. He stared down at the file on his desk. On paper, she was dynamite. Charlie had seen plenty of men who were dynamite on paper, but didn't stack up when the shit hit the fan. His men came from all over, all ex-special ops from a half dozen different countries. They'd earned their spots on this team. It didn't matter that this job was crap, turning his warriors into a bunch of facility guards alternating shifts, mostly checking people's paperwork, controlling access to the Mingster and the Atlas Cavern. He still needed people he knew. But this assignment had come from Jacob Kroner himself. No way could Charlie tell Paladin's hard-nosed president he didn't want the woman. That was all right. Just because she made it onto the team didn't mean she'd last long enough to be a thorn in his side. Charlie rose to his feet, slid into his coat, and stepped out into the cold parking lot, where he'd assembled his team for this announcement. As he looked at them, 17 cocky bastards, each one a major ass-kicker, he grinned.
"We've been assigned Bruce's replacement. Her name is Inga Hedstrom. She arrives this afternoon."
He held up his hand to quiet the low mutters.
"You know I like to choose my own people. This one's out of my hands. But she still has to measure up."
Charlie clasped his hands behind his back, the posture thrusting his massive chest forward.
"I'm sure you gentlemen will show her a proper welcome."
Artan Yuzman, the larger of the team's two Turks, chuckled.
"You can count on it, boss."
Chapter 113.
Mark wouldn't have imagined ever wanting to thank Dr. Stevenson for anything, but he'd been responsible for Mark's reassignment to the Atlas Electrical Construction Team. That would have happened without outside help, but after Stevenson had looked at the Gantt charts, he'd immediately seen the correlation between Mark's assignments and a tremendous increase in productivity. So now Mark was the Atlas team foreman.
He began his new job by instructing his crew to continue as planned while he spent a couple of days familiarizing himself with the cage, a monstrous construct of steel supports and metal grating that extended from the cavern floor to the ceiling, 90 meters above. The cage housed all the power cables routed into the Atlas cavern from the Minkster and provided support for the cooling equipment required to maintain superconductivity in the primary power lines. It was a towering steel structure, so tightly packed with cable and equipment that workers had to worm their way through crawlways that some of them refused to enter. Mark traced every inch of cable that had been run and every electrical component already installed, comparing each item against the memorized plans. Although he found a number of minor variances or shortcuts, he found no significant deviations until halfway through Wednesday's second shift. Deep within the most densely packed vertical section, he identified a cable that wasn't on the plans. Fascinated, he stayed on into the third shift, following the mysterious line down toward the cavern floor. The way it meandered down through other cable groupings, it had clearly been installed with the intent of making what Mark was doing almost impossible. At floor level, the cable split into four lines, made to look like standard 220-volt, 50-hertz power lines. That disappeared into groupings of similar lines. The third shift ended at midnight, but Mark continued. At 4:30 a.m., he finally stopped, convinced that he knew where each of the four cables terminated. The odd part was that they disappeared into four separate prefabricated load-bearing steel and concrete buttresses. There was nothing electrical in these buttresses. At least, there wasn't supposed to be. Returning to the spot high up in the cage where he'd first discovered the mysterious cable, Mark began tracing it back the other way, toward the spot where the cage exited the cavern roof. Reaching the level of the skywalk, the scaffolding walkway that connected the cage to the steel scaffolding lining the cavern walls, Mark squeezed between two trusses and stopped. High up along the backside of one of the trusses, the cable passed through an encyclopedia-sized unmarked metal box. Working his way back out of the tight space, Mark moved to one of the electrical tool cabinets mounted at regular intervals throughout the cage, grabbed the tools he needed, and returned to the mysterious box. Unfastening the cover, Mark took extreme care to avoid tilting or vibrating the case, easing it open while holding the penlight in his teeth. Just enough to give him a glimpse inside. Not good. Attached to the inside of the removable front cover, a small glass ampoule held a silvery liquid bubble at one end. A mercury switch. If he'd just pulled the thing open, that shiny little bubble would have rolled to the other end. Mark didn't care to find out what would happen if the silver globule made that trip. Mark removed the cover, keeping its angle unchanged, and examined the wiring inside the case. It formed a simple circuit connected to a currently unset digital timer. Whether the mercury switch was rigged to bypass the timer or send an alert wasn't immediately clear, and Mark didn't feel like putting in the effort to figure it out right now. He'd already figured out what this whole set of cabling represented. Some government, probably the United States, had rigged a failsafe device. Within each of those four prefabbed buttresses was a nuclear bomb. It was the only thing that made sense, even though it didn't make any. They had to know that a nuclear detonation would just feed the anomaly, turning it into an instant black hole. So they'd put these here as a last resort. So long as Stevenson's wormhole device worked, they'd never be used. Replacing the cover, Mark wormed his way out to the railing surrounding the cage's top level and onto the skywalk. It was time to take a moment to meditate and contact Heather. He'd let his personal savant figure out what she wanted him to do about the nukes.
Chapter 114.
A training accident?
Charlie Richardson slammed his fist down on the desk as he looked at his executive officer. Bob Jones shrugged.
Shit happens.
Like hell it does. Not on my team. Not to three of my top people.
Charlie got to his feet, stretching his 6.5-foot frame.
You're saying Artan and Hito both took a tumble while racing on the confidence course?
Yep. Right near the top of the high log climb. Artan slipped, tumbled into Hito, and they both fell.
Right on top of Diego?
Actually, Diego tried to break their fall.
Charlie stood nose to nose with Bob, his gray eyes locking with the other man's brown ones.
Now tell me the real story. No attribution.
Does that apply to the whole team?
It does.
Bob nodded, plopping down on the couch across from Charlie's desk.
You're going to want to sit down for this one, boss.
You know how you told the boys to show our new recruit a proper welcome? Make sure she has what it takes?
I remember.
Well, they've been giving her the business. Nothing major. Just screwing with her stuff. Sexual comments, alternating with the silent treatment, letting her know the president may have put her here, but she isn't one of us. Basically making her life hell. This morning she'd had enough of it. We were formed up for PT, out where we've rigged our hand-to-hand combat training pit. When she stepped out of formation and walked right up beside me, in front of them all. I thought she was going to break down, call it quits, start pleading or something. You could hear the fellas laughing, so I stepped aside and let her have the floor. You know what she said?
No, I don't know what she said, and I don't want to guess. Get to the damned point.
She just stood there, with the team gathered around her in an arc. I'll never forget her voice if I live 1,000 years. It was throaty, smooth as silk, the sexiest voice I've ever heard. She looked them all up and down, then said, "Let's make a deal. You pick your best man. If he beats me hand to hand here in the pit, every one of you can have a turn at me. And I'll be the best piece of ass you've ever had."
Shit, you could have heard a pin drop. There was so much testosterone in the air it was flammable.
Then she said, "But if I win, you're going to show me the same respect you show each other. Do we have a deal?"
And?
And she had a deal. The boys argued about who would do the fighting, but finally Diego Vasquez won out.
Charlie nodded. Vasquez was the only guy on the team stronger than he was, and quick as a mongoose.
So what happened?
Diego came at her full bore, just exploded out of the pack. It was the damnedest thing I've ever seen. It was like Inga knew his moves before he made them. She cracked his ribs on that first charge, just used his momentum to add power to her kick. It dropped him to his knees, left him gasping for air. But she was already on his back, her arms locked around his neck in a submission chokehold, cutting off the blood supply to his brain. Diego's eyes just stared in disbelief, then rolled up in his head. Once he was out, she dropped him at her feet.
I was so surprised, the two Turks charged before I could stop them.
Artan reached her first, tried a flying takedown, and got a mouthful of his own teeth when her elbow flattened him. Hito pulled up in a fighter's stance. He might as well have been blindfolded with his arms tied behind his back. Her first kick broke his kneecap. Her next one caved in the side of his face. Once he was on the ground, she stomped his rib cage. Thought she was going to kill him. About that time, Artan distracted her by climbing back to his feet. He didn't stay there long, though. Anyway, when she was done, she turned around to face the rest of us. I swear to God, she wasn't even breathing hard. All she said was, "Anyone else?" But she didn't get any volunteers. Then she turned her back on us and walked away. So that's why those three are in the hospital. Diego's in the best shape. He'll probably be released tomorrow. Artan and Hito are going to be there for a while.
I guess she didn't take kindly to the Turks breaking her deal.
I tell you what, boss, I wouldn't screw with her.
Charlie nodded.
so it was a training accident.
Just like I said.
Looks like we've got a new teammate. Spread the word.
Bob rose to his feet, opened the door, and paused.
I don't have to.
The door to the command hooch banged closed behind him.
Chapter 115. The knock on his door roused Freddy from the light doze that had almost allowed the glass of Crown Royal to slip from his fingers. Shit, what time was it? The LED lights on the cable box were at 11:45. Who the hell would come knocking at midnight? Freddy thought about grabbing his snub-nosed 38, but what if it was the Ripper? The 38 would just get him killed. Setting the glass on the end table, Freddy slid out of the easy chair and stumbled to the door. Wiping a hand over his face, he took a deep breath to clear his head and opened the door. It took a full 5 seconds for Freddy's mind to process the girl standing before him. She was a petite Asian in jeans and a purple camisole that left her navel exposed. At least he didn't see any piercings.
Wrong house. The party must be down the street.
Freddy Hagerman?
What of it?
I understand you met with Denise Jennings of the NSA at the Thomas Jefferson building.
Now she had his attention.
Freddy motioned her toward the couch, but she remained where she was.
I won't be here long enough to come in or sit down. I came here to give you this.
She handed him a leather valise he had mistaken for her purse and stepped back, her eyes as black as her hair.
I think you'll find that I finished the work Denise started. I understand you know what to do with it.
Mind if I ask a couple of questions? Actually, he had more than a couple of questions.
No need. If the answer isn't in what I just gave you, I don't know it.
Your name?
Goodbye, Mr. Hagerman.
She turned and walked down the dark driveway and climbed inside a small car. No interior light came on when she opened the door. Neither did she turn on her headlights when she drove away. So much for getting the license plate number. Freddy stared after her as she turned the corner at the end of his block. Then he closed the door, walked into the kitchen, and spread the valise's contents across the kitchen table. 3 coffee pots later, with the first gray of dawn lightening his windows, he knew that she had spoken the truth. He also knew that if the Ripper hadn't told him not to publish the story until after November Anomaly Gateway Day, he would already be on his way to New York.
Chapter 116. Donald Stevenson paced the Atlas Cavern like a lion in a cage. It was strangely quiet. He'd given the entire staff 8 hours off, instructing the G-Day crew to report promptly at 4 a.m. to begin the 6-hour countdown. They'd been shocked. The cavern always had a night crew. But tonight, Donald wanted to savor the culmination of his life's work alone. As he walked among the massive equipment, his footsteps echoing, and looked up at the steel scaffolding draping the cavern walls, a sudden chill raised goose flesh on his arms. It reminded him of another November night, so many years ago, when he'd stood in another man-made cavern, alone with the Rose Ship. The truth was, that moment had been the purest of his life. The sense of discovery, the revelations, the renewed sense of purpose when, even though many thought him successful, in his mind he had just been spinning his wheels. Mankind imagined itself a highly evolved species, or, even more bizarrely, as the one all-powerful God's greatest creation. But on that first night when Donald had made his way alone into the Rose Ship, he had discovered proof of what he had always thought to be true. Man was no more than an adolescent species on a backwater planet in an aging galaxy. If the Rose Ship hadn't been so horribly damaged in its combat with the Ultrian starship,
It wouldn't have taken Donald so long to prepare the way for mankind's next evolutionary leap. But through all these years of baby steps and setbacks, Donald had persisted, until those steps had finally deposited him on destiny's doorstep. Odd how his fate seemed entwined with Thanksgiving, like some cosmic circadian rhythm. For the first time in a very long time, a genuine smile creased his ageless face. Tomorrow, on Thanksgiving Day in America, he would change the world.
Chapter 117. The Anomaly Transport and Control Center, ATAC, looked nothing like anything Ted Cantrell had imagined. When he and his CNN news crew had arrived to begin setup for the most important broadcast in history, he'd expected to find something like the NASA flight control room at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. A room filled with banks of high-tech workstations, arranged in a neat grid in front of a wall filled with large display screens. This felt more like the Batcave. The Atlas Cavern was huge, the walls draped with steel lattice construction, grated metal walkways leading to metal stairs, each of these girded with steel rails that were all that prevented someone from stumbling into a deadly fall. High up along one of the topmost levels, international camera crews and media had been allotted space to set up cameras and on-site reporting stations. Every available space along the long, narrow walkway was packed with equipment and cables, with open space reserved only for the network anchors. Eschewing an anchor desk, Ted had decided to stand back against the blue railing, allowing the camera to frame him against the huge cavern that opened up behind him. Despite the tight operating space, the view was breathtaking. Its great form rising 30 meters from the central cavern floor, the row gateway device resembled an inverted horseshoe magnet, its metal walls 5 meters thick, its outer surface sprouting appendages that looked like the buds on a potato left too long in its sack. Huge cables snaked out from a massive steel structure that rose 300 feet from the cavern floor, terminating on those buds or disappearing beneath the ATAC. They were the lines designed to carry more power than any power plant on Earth had ever generated. As Ted stared at them, he felt the hair rise up on his neck and arms. Despite the thick layers of insulation that surrounded each of those cables, he wondered if that power might not burst free, sending uncontrolled electrical arcs crawling across all this steel latticework. But if he felt dangerously exposed up here, what must it have felt like to be one of the hundreds of scientists and technicians who occupied and surrounded the ATAC? Rather than being constructed at a safe distance from the gateway, the control center was snuggled up against it, wrapping the monstrous piece of equipment as if they were two lovers spooning up in bed. Safety and beauty had been sacrificed at the altar of speed, reducing the length of thousands of cables and putting scientists in position to directly observe and react as required. 10 meters from the gateway mouth stood the large metal shell that housed the vacuum chamber and electromagnetic containment fields designed to slow the November anomaly's death spiral. If all went well, they wouldn't need it much longer. If things didn't go well, it wouldn't matter. According to top scientists on the program, the anomaly's descent into instability continued to accelerate, as Dr. Stevenson's equations had predicted. If the gateway device failed today, there wouldn't be a second chance. The noise along the high ramp picked up as foreign news organizations began their broadcasts. Jan Fernandez, his assigned makeup artist, stepped forward to pat his face down with a powder puff, erasing the beads of sweat that had popped out on his brow despite the cool temperature here in the cavern.
30 seconds to air!
Ted nodded at his producer, took several deep breaths, and just as he'd done in crisis after crisis around the world, put on his game face. From his left to his right, the 3 eye-level monitors mounted on the walkway's metal wall showed CNN's Atlanta feed,
his own image, and a tight shot of Dr. Stevenson sitting on a high perch above the other ATAC scientists, surrounded by keyboards and monitors. Bob Marley, the Atlanta anchor, spoke in his ear.
"We go now to the best crisis reporter anywhere, CNN's own Ted Cantrell."
It was showtime. Chapter 118. Cohort Commander Keaton Ra moved down the line, inspecting his assault team with the confidence that came from many such missions across the galaxy. Its mission wasn't easy, but it wasn't complicated either. Wait for the gateway to synchronize with the signal from the far end, activate the portal, then charge through to secure the other side, establishing a beachhead for the army that would follow. Then, all the heavy firepower and advanced weaponry available to the follow-on force would bring yet another world into the Kasari Collective. But that army would not be allowed through the gateway until his team had finished its work. His special assault team would take some losses. There was little doubt of that. It happened in almost every assault. The result of being denied any ranged weapons that might damage or disrupt the far gate. The far-end gateways were always fragile technological implementations, the best these primitive worlds could construct, even given a world ship tutorial. Denied even low-power disruptor weapons, his team would rely on the initial surprise and shock their assault would generate, and on their martial arts training, bladed weapons and nano-enhanced bodies to secure the objective. There would be some security presence on the far end, but it would be minimal. It always was. Nobody opened a Kasari gateway with the expectation of welcoming in an assault force. The planet expected what the world ship had conditioned it to expect. The reason they'd gone to all the effort to construct the gateway. So the special assault team would rock them back on their heels, and another portal would be secured. Then, the signal would be given, and the army would pour through, extending the perimeter, bringing the transporters, sky riders, heavy equipment, and the rest of the Kasari logistics train. Finishing his inspection of his chosen dozen, Keaton Ra motioned his sergeant forward, assuming the position of attention as his top veteran inspected Keaton Ra with the same meticulous routine that he'd used on the team. Standard operating procedure. Nobody went into combat without undergoing a thorough inspection, especially not commanders. As the sergeant moved around him, touching each item of equipment, his comm unit sounded the alert. The far gateway had powered up, preparing to go active. Once that happened, it would only be a matter of allowing the two gates to synchronize signals before the portal stabilized. A warm glow worked its way up from his 2 feet into Keaton Ra's legs and torso, spreading into his forearms, his neck, and then his head. It was almost go time.
Chapter 119. Even for Ted, reporting on the culmination of the November Anomaly Project was a little overwhelming. As he started in on his coverage, he knew he sounded a little unsure of himself. As he continued, though, his veteran instincts kicked in, the nerves went away, and it all became automatic. Having hit his stride, Ted gestured toward the cavern that fell away before his platform.
"What we are about to see is the single most important event since the dawn of life on this planet, the culmination of the most ambitious science and engineering project ever conceived by man. During the next hour, Dr. Stevenson and the scientists working on the November Anomaly Project will attempt to use technologies reverse-engineered from the Roe Project alien starship. Some of these technologies have never before been tested, much less utilized on this scale. Over the last 8 months, in the huge cavern behind me and above ground a short distance from here, the world's best scientists and engineers have constructed 4 devices crucial to pulling off today's attempt at saving the human race. The first is the only above-ground component, a power plant built using alien matter disruptor technology that will provide the awesome power required by the systems here in the Atlas Cavern. Ted was well aware that his TV audience was seeing not just him and the Atlas Cavern, but a sequence of 3D computer animations designed to illustrate what he was talking about. Two more critical pieces of equipment are not visible in the cavern below, buried as they are within the walls of the equipment on the cavern floor below. These are actually two identical copies of the same thing, a device called a stasis field generator. They are designed to generate and manipulate powerful force fields that will be used to isolate the November anomaly and move it into the gateway that will transport it into space. The shot shifted to the camera, showing the ATAC gradually zooming out until the massive gateway device filled the screen. Right now you are looking at the heart of the project, the rogue gateway device. Pausing momentarily for dramatic effect, Ted continued. This is the engineering marvel that will create a wormhole through which the scientists will push the November anomaly using the stasis field generators. Once the anomaly has been pushed into the wormhole, the rogue gateway device will be powered down, closing the wormhole and eliminating the threat to our planet forever. The lighting in the cavern acquired an amber hue as the PA system sounded. Initial stasis field power countdown commencing. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Engaging power. There was a brief pause, followed by another announcement. Stasis field generator power steady at 10% on both systems. Commencing 1 minute countdown to full power ramp. Ted turned sideways to enhance the camera's view of his profile silhouetted against the gateway. Now it starts getting dicey. This countdown will take us to the point where scientists bring the two stasis field generators to full power. While it's nowhere close to the amount of power the gateway device will use, it's still more than the total amount of power used by the Large Hadron Collider over the entire course of its operation. He found he was sweating profusely. It all came down to this. Again, the loudspeaker sounded out the final 10 seconds of the countdown. Initiating power ramp. 50%. 70%. 95%. Stasis field generator power stabilized at 100%. All systems nominal. The sound of clapping echoed up from the cavern floor. Ted smiled, relieved. You can feel the tension in that applause. The PA system squawked. Commencing 1 minute countdown to row gateway power ramp. Ted turned back to face the camera. I have to admit to a little dry mouth. Unlike the stasis field generator power-up, the gateway is going to be ramped to full power without a pause. The scientists will power it up, but they won't activate it until after the November anomaly is isolated by the primary stasis field generator. As the final countdown sounded, the camera shifted to a tight shot of the gateway device. Gateway device power ramp initiated. Ted felt his hair stand on end, but he couldn't be sure if it was static electricity in the air or the tension in his body. In front of him, the producer and the camera people had a kind of tension too, their bodies just going through the motions. They appeared to Ted like poorly designed computer simulations of the team he knew so well. Power at 50%, 75, 90, 95, 98. There was a brief pause in the announcements. Gateway device power stabilized at 99.3% of maximum. Once again, the sound of applause rang out from the scientists and technicians assembled below. Ted exhaled. I know you must be wondering why they're clapping, since we didn't get to 100% power. I sure am. For an explanation, we go to Dr. Gerda Freiholt, a physicist from the Matter Disruptor team. Thank you for taking the time to help us understand what is happening.
The camera shifted to a white-coated woman with her gray hair pulled back in a severe bun.
My pleasure. As you can tell from the reaction from our ATAC crew, 99% power is excellent. The system was designed with a certain amount of tolerance. While we would have loved to hit the 100% target, anything over 95% is good.
That's good to know. We have a couple of minutes until the next phase. Can you give us a quick overview of what scientists will be trying to do with the stasis field generators?
Well, first, they are going to use the primary stasis field generator to capture and isolate the November anomaly. Right now, the anomaly is contained by powerful magnetic fields within a vacuum chamber.
The camera switched to a view of the steel ball suspended a few meters in front of the gateway device opening.
When the stasis field is directed at the anomaly containment apparatus, it will instantaneously cut through all that steel, which will fall away onto the cavern floor. However, the stasis field will move at the speed of light,